Turning to Esther this evening to chapter 2. As I mentioned before we began reading earlier, the book introduces an aspect of the experience of King Ahasuerus, known elsewhere as Xerxes, known elsewhere as a very, very powerful king. One commentator remarks about the book of Esther that the narrator is clearly very secure in himself or herself, writing very freely about these less than flattering sides of aspects of Persian royalty. There are not many other forms of history where they might have got away with it, but this writer is very, very secure, and it is handed down to us in Scripture. And it's this less than flattering side of Persian royalty where we resume in chapter 2. It begins with royalty, certain things that are going on in the royal presence, and then there is an interesting little twist. It's quite surprising, perhaps, given the historical context of these great people, this great palace and citadel and so on. The Persians are the mighty ones. And then right in the middle of it, it makes mention that in that citadel is a certain Jew. It's quite surprising in the historical context, less so when we find it in the Hebrew Bible. As we go on then through the story where this Jew and another with him, Mordecai and Hadassah or Esther, as they feature through the rest of the story, they are negotiating quite tricky waters. And they do it with some presence of mind and quite a measure of poise. It's for that reason that another strand of thought regarding this book is that it's one of the wisdom books. Wisdom being, whether it be Proverbs or Job, that it's teaching how to live well in this complex world. And you do see something of that, at least the survival instincts, but something of the character that is reflected in the text here. So we see something of that. So it has something of a wisdom character to it, biblical Hebrew scriptural wisdom literature. But I would make the point that what they do, how Esther and Mordecai do behave, is their response to events by and large. And it's their response to the behavior of others, events and others outside of their control. And so it takes us further than simply demonstrating the effective application of wisdom. If you look through some of the things that we are told in this narrative, are these events mere coincidence? Or is there a greater guiding hand behind them and their combination? So we will examine a little further in this evening, just as far as chapter 2, and here to reflect on the bearing of, first of all, the royal pleasure, and then secondly, Esther's roots, and this is really just following through the development of the chapter, Esther's roots, where she comes from, then Esther's rise, and lastly, the last section, Mordecai's loyalty. First then, the royal pleasure, and here I'm especially attending to verses 1 through to 4. The great feast of chapter 1 has passed into mere memory. The king has settled down. It tells us that his wrath subsided, and he remembered Vashti. And there's something a bit poignant about the way this is told us. He remembered her, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. There's something of the tone that he was at least a touch regretful at his earlier haste. What had been decreed against her? And the servants around him make a very prompt response. In verse 2 and following, they've got some answer to this to provide a gap filler. He knows a gap in his life from the loss of Vashti. Now here's a way of filling it or replacing her. Something of a beauty contest, you might say. But it's not a beauty contest by application, as far as I can see. They simply say, you need to let these be sought for the king. Go out and the officers in verse 3 should go out and gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan the citadel. Not so much by application, as beauty contests may be these days, but they are to be gathered and brought into under the custody in verse 3 of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the woman. So it was perhaps another of these major decrees that this powerful king extended throughout his provinces, that no one would dare to go against or to resist. And so these beautiful young virgins were to be brought together, and the king could have his look and his pick and his choice of them. And there is the theme of the royal pleasure brought to the fore. The narrator picks up how the servants in verse 4, let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king. For someone in such power, was that all that mattered, what pleased him? Perhaps it was, when we see what happened in chapter 1, that where Vashti displeased him, she was gone. This, what is it that pleases the king of the nation, the great empire? That seems to be what happens, what takes place. But we do learn, don't we, in Proverbs, amongst other things, and Proverbs sums it up very well. In chapter 16 of Proverbs, verse 9, tells us that a man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. So it's going on in man's mind, whether it be the servants or the king in response to their suggestions. This is man's plan, but the Lord is directing his steps. Or in Proverbs 21, beginning of the chapter, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. Yes, it was the king's pleasure. It pleased him. Do as you please, the servant said. But in the end, God's word tells us that even the king's heart is turned how God wishes it to be, is pleased to turn it. Here are the schemes of the servants, with some ingenuity, maybe political awareness. They're placating a temperamental spirit. It reminds me of David, who was brought in to play the harp for King Saul. King's pleasure, a powerful man, all the more powerful then than today. Depends on a mere whim, yet in the Lord's hands. The events that take place are left before the reader, the one who did read these things should be aware of the rest of Scripture, which, as we've read in Proverbs, has example teaching us of what may well ought to be understood behind the way that this man's mind was working. And then to come to, from verse 5 onwards, where all of this has been taking place, the corridors of power, and then it tells us about this Jew. It doesn't tell us very much about him. It tells us which family he came from, and that his family were one of those families that had been taken out of Jerusalem when King Nebuchadnezzar overran the city. Verses 5 and 6. in the light of those grand affairs of state, yes, even the acquisition of a new queen, what does this small man from Judah have to do with it? Maybe just a remark regarding the beginning of verse 6. You'll see if you, most of the Bibles have the verse beginning with Kish, but it's in italics, and that is telling us that the translators have actually inserted the name there. It is literally the word who. And the problem is that nobody knows quite who that who refers back to from the previous verse. But it would seem to make a great deal of sense. The timing that we're looking at for this whole story is about 100, 110 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. So it would seem to make sense that it is a stylized depiction of Mordecai's family. It tells us the main point of it is that he is from the tribe of Benjamin, who had been amalgamated into the Jews of the time. But remember that it does cover from the time that's referred to that had been carried away with the captives by Nebuchadnezzar, that is over 100 years later. So Mordecai would not have been the one who himself was taken away from Jerusalem, but his family had been. Those who had been captured with Jeconiah, in the book of Kings, it's Jehoiachin, but he only reigned for 3 months, and then Nebuchadnezzar had enough and took him away with most of the nobility, most of those who were skilled craftsmen, and you might well say the upper classes, the ones who could offer something to the Babylonian Empire. The poor people were left behind. But it tells us a little bit about what you might expect the lineage of Mordecai. He was of the Benjamites. If he was of the family of Kish, of Benjamin, then it would say that he's related to Saul, King Saul. So there was royal blood there as well. So there was, perhaps you might say, minor nobility in some way. There's nothing else that we have around him. We don't know how he was living. We don't know what kind of society he held prior to this. But it would indicate that he was one of those that were useful to the society of the empires from Babylon through the Persians and so on. It might also help us to understand how he was took part in the rest of the story, and he took up that part. For example, at the end of the chapter it tells us that he sat in the gate, and that's an indication of someone who was given a role such as a magistrate, someone who was involved in minor judgments of state, of society, and he was able to take on that role, perhaps because he knew that, or had been prepared through those several generations, having been taken from Jerusalem. It's a reminder, too, of the reality of the story of Hadassah, Esther. We see in verse 7 that she was his uncle's daughter. In other words, she was his cousin. He took her and looked after her as his own daughter, so there was an age difference, but he was her cousin. She was an orphan. Her father and her mother had died. She was an orphan, but not an orphan on the streets. She was an orphan within a craftsman's family, at least, someone who had a place in society, if not some minor nobility. She wasn't dragged up from the streets. She had been cared for by this man, this cousin, Mordecai. And that background that we can well consider was being probably passed on to her, enabling her to conduct herself in society. The other aspect that I would want to highlight, why do we dwell on this, and why does the book of Esther expand on this as it does? Not very far, but enough. Why is that? Well, let's remember what we're told here, that in Shushan, on this day, around these events, he was this man Mordecai, but he'd been brought to Shushan. He'd actually been brought to Babylon or the provinces. He'd been brought, or at least his family had been brought there, over 100 years ago, before this. It's Mordecai later who says to Esther, maybe you're here for this particular occasion. There's something about it that these things are recorded for us to just take a moment and trace them back, is to help us to realize that while this seems to be about the king's whim, just one day he condemned his own wife, his queen, to banishment, and then he had to find a solution to that problem, comes up with an idea. Is this all just happening off the top of men's heads? But as the story unfolds, Mordecai plays a crucial role in it. So does Esther all the more. And they are there because God directed Nebuchadnezzar to take these nobility and craftsmen at least 100 years earlier. Isn't it just an example, a parallel example to my mind, is where we pray to the Lord to give us this day our daily bread. Is that so that we have bread on the table tomorrow morning, or cereal, whatever it is, for breakfast? But remember where that comes from. The bread has been made in the bakery. The bakery takes the flour, has prepared the flour, it's taken some time to do it, and the yeast has taken time to mature. And it comes from the crops, perhaps 6 months beforehand, which comes from the planting 6 months before that, and the seed, which was planted there at creation. What happens today isn't just about today. What happened in Shushan that day, and Esther's appearance amongst the young and the beautiful when the king was rounding them up, wasn't an accident, and it didn't just happen on that day. These things have been working step by step, that she should be there at that point. Esther's roots. The royal pleasure took place. That's in place. Esther's roots, they took place. That's in place. And so you come to Esther's rise. Those things meet together. Esther, this young woman, young beautiful woman, her life crosses with one of the greatest, most powerful men of all time. How does she handle it? And that something of that is reflected in the rest of chapter 2. She handles it, first of all, with guidance from her cousin. She handles it with some grace. It says several times that for different people she found grace and favor. For Haggai, first of all, and then with those around her, she found grace and favor, and then with the king, she found grace and favor. She handles it with grace. She handles it with some practical wisdom and discretion. And that's against a background which would have been quite testing. You might say, well, if this is a beauty contest, no one coerced her or anybody else to become subject to the king's plan of action. But I don't think that really understands the context of the time. In those days, if the king said, come, you came. It would be very surprising as well to think of a Jew voluntarily facing prospect of putting herself into the way of a possible marriage with a pagan, and especially a pagan king who would have to administer. He was the leader of pagan worship in his nation, his empire. Or to voluntarily subject herself to the courtly regime. Remember Daniel. Not so long before this, Daniel refused to eat the king's food. It's around about within the same general period of time where Ezra and Nehemiah were adamant that Israel or the Jews should not engage in marriage with the pagan nations around them. If this was something was to be found somewhere in the spirit of the Jewish people of the time, whether in exile or back in Jerusalem, It does seem strange to think that Esther might have deliberately put herself into the way of this, rather that she was coerced, that she was one of those who were, yes, to put it bluntly, rounded up. That she had no real option, but her options lay in how to respond to it. So what does she do? She goes into this context, into the custody of Haggai, who was looking after these women for the king, and she keeps her, we discover in verse 10 that she keeps her origins obscure, doesn't reveal her people or kindred. Under the instruction of Mordecai, he says, don't tell them. Doesn't tell us why he didn't tell them. We can perhaps work out some ideas, but it doesn't tell us why. But she wasn't asked any questions, so she doesn't volunteer any answers. It is possible, we know from one of the Greek historians of the time that the Persian kings were only supposed to take a wife from one of the other six major noble Persian families. But it doesn't appear that the king was too bothered about that. He was prepared to take just someone from this group of, works out at roughly over 1,000 young women, wherever they came from. Was it that the Jews were already something of a despised group or a feared group? We see later with Haman, when he discovers Mordecai was a Jew, he uses it very opportunistically, as such that they were not would not be fit for royal associations. What is behind it? We can't be sure. How do we interpret it? Do we interpret Mordecai as being underhand? Or was Mordecai simply being wise, not drawing attention to this? I would incline to that it would be unhelpful, that this attention might be drawn to this particular point. So much of what is going on in this story is prejudice. Even the prejudice where the way that these young women were being treated is, we would certainly say by today's standards, awful. It's all about physical beauty. And so much more to women than that. So it was Mordecai simply being wise in the circumstances. I would suggest he was. But what I also notice is that in this whole matter, in approaching this matter, we don't see any record of Mordecai or Esther asking God what to do. Considering how often the other books in the Old Testament do refer to asking God's direction, it's notable that the two named Jews in this story don't ask God for direction. How do we deal with this, Lord? They do show remarkable practical judgment and wisdom. Their approach in the people that they deal with, and Esther especially, is considerate, it's gracious. We'll see a little later how loyal Mordecai was, both to Esther and to the king. There's something in Esther about her character that comes out, that she's not just amongst the most beautiful of the women, but she's noted to be she gains favor, that there's something about her that pleases those that she deals with and meets with. She's very astute. In verse 15, when she has the opportunity to take whatever she wants with her as she goes to meet with the king, she turns to the man who's been looking after her, and she says, just you tell me, you advise me, and that's what I'll do. Somebody who knows the king, she's a wise woman, a young woman, a wise woman. If she was going to have any success, you might say, she's going the right way about it. And let's not be too raise too many objections to a pursuit of success in these circumstances. Bear in mind what's going on here. It's we're told very few things, but you can put them all together and you can get a much bigger picture. If she was not successful, as all the other young women were not successful, she would be consigned to virtual imprisonment. They were taken, after being with the king, they were taken, it tells us, to the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. What that meant was virtual imprisonment in the concubines' quarters, and there's discoveries of archaeological discoveries which show them to be tiny little places. Enslavement, she was probably well clothed and maybe well fed, but she was cut off from the rest of society. She had been in the king's presence, and the king no doubt entered sexual relations with her for one night, and she was kept for him when he might never see her again, kept away from marriage and family for the rest of her life. And then, if you add up a couple of other items of information we have, in chapter 1, verse 3, it tells us that the great banquet was held in Ahasuerus' third year of his reign. In chapter 2, verse 16, Esther is taken in the seventh year, so 4 years later. Now remember, too, that the beauty treatments were to take 12 months. So the very first of these young women who would meet with the king would be in the fourth year of the king's reign. Esther gets there in the seventh year, so 3 years later. Each woman has one night with the king. 3 years, 365 days each year, takes you over a thousand young women. And that's the context in which this happens. It's little wonder that they, Mordecai and Esther, between them, put as much of their wisdom into exercise as possible. It's little wonder as well that verse 11 tells us Mordecai paced in front of the court to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Let's understand the context, what's going on at this point. In her wisdom, she handles it as best she can, but there's also something about her where she is found to be of a gracious character. Verse 17 tells us that when she did meet with the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. Loved here is not the what we would normally use the word love for. It is at the level of attracted to her. And as the story goes on, we see that she's not in his presence every day, but he is attracted to her, and she'll fill the gap. But there's something about her that is different from the rest, and sufficiently that he picks her, that he chooses her for his new queen. She had been, I suggest, trained in, with a good spirit and a good mind. She had the beginnings of a queenly quality. She couldn't go into it with timidity, while at the same time not being overbearing. There are those notes of biblical wisdom, training in the practice of righteousness, the influence of Jewish culture, which was in turn led by God's ancient instruction of the Israelite people. Now, I put this in this way because that's another aspect we need to bear in mind as we go through this. When I introduced it last week, I was making the point that we don't see God being named here. I've said it this evening, we don't see them turning to God for direction. Are they people of faith? We're not absolutely certain, but we don't have the indications that we do of others that they were. They're here living according to wisdom, which was constantly being taught to those who grew up in the Jewish culture. I think it's perhaps a bit akin to what we call Christian influences in Britain and in the West. So that still some folk do, or at least they insist that they know what is the Christian thing to do. And in many ways they're not far off the mark. There is the behaviour of a gentleman. There are those things of health and of consideration towards others. These are things that arise out of Christian instruction. And they have had an influence, and that influence continues within society. But I stress that because it is not the same as then confessing God to be Lord and ruler of all things. Nor is it the same as confessing God to be my personal leader and Lord. It's not the same. It's living according to, you might say, a Christianized culture as we speak of Christendom. There are certain standards that are embedded in society, and we can follow those things through. And it looks like the Christian thing to do. But it's not the same as confessing him to be the Holy One, to whom exclusive service belongs, whatever the cost. I say that because that's what you see with Daniel. He was in the corridors of power, but it didn't compromise one bit his pursuit of the worship of God, the service of God. Those other things came second. We just don't see exact evidence of that approach in Mordecai and Esther. Yes, you might well say, biblical wisdom. It's not to be unduly harsh or nitpicking with these people, but I make the point because we must be cautious of assuming that these were coming at it in a spiritual way, as shining spiritual lights, which is something that has been done at times as folk have come to Esther and Mordecai. They did what they did